since the 9/11 attacks back in 2001, every place that you can imagine has just really emphasized the idea of security. Obviously, airports are no longer anything close to what they used to be. I remember making a few airplane flights before 9/11, and I've made many since then, and they are nothing close to the same. Security has just gone through the roof. Security at government buildings, security at all kinds of public buildings, security in schools, security in the workplace is important. In many places now, you have an ID badge or an ID card, something that you swipe or something that you have to present to someone. And the purpose of those security badges and cards and pins and all of those things is to ask a question: whether you belong there. Do you belong in that workplace? Do you belong in that building? They're very concerned about that. I want us to look today at Psalm number 15, which was just read for us. Psalm number 15, and it asks a very similar question. Psalm 15 is talking about the appearance of Israelites in the presence of God, and it's asking a question: do you belong here? Do you belong in this assembly? And really, the application that every one of us needs to make is we need to ask the same thing when we appear in the presence of God to worship Him, is do we belong here? And the interesting thing to me is the criteria that the psalmist uses may not quite be the criteria that we would come up with, but it's certainly relevant to his discussion about worshiping God. So we're going to look this morning at Psalm number 15. We're told, as you look at the background, first of all, there's a little bit of a contrast with Psalm number 14. Psalm number 14 is about the one who doesn't even believe in God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And later he talks, at the end of Psalm 14, he talks about salvation coming out of Zion. Well, Psalm 15 is set in Zion. It is set on God's holy hill. It's set in the place of the temple or the tabernacle. He's talking about God restoring the fortunes of his people. Psalm 15 is talking about those who do believe in God. The fool, Psalm 14, wants nothing to do with God, wants nothing to do with worshiping God, but the man described in Psalm number 15 very much wants to do with it and seeks to be in the presence of God. We're told in the title that it is a Psalm of David. That phrase that's used there at the beginning of Psalm 15 is in the Hebrew is La David, and that carries a wide range of meaning. It may mean authorship. It probably usually means that, but sometimes it could mean dedicated to David, could mean in the style of one of David's psalms. I do happen to think that Psalm 15 is probably written by David. If so, it talks about the holy hill. It talks about the tabernacle. It would imply that David is already king. It would imply that David has settled in the city of Jerusalem. It would imply that the tabernacle has been set up in Jerusalem as the place of worship, so it belongs to after the first few years of David's reign as king. And this is something that appears to be the case. It appears to be what is called an entrance liturgy. It deals with the entrance requirements. Whoever would come in the presence of God has to meet certain requirements. Now, Mike read for us at the beginning of the worship period from Psalm number 24. Psalm number 24 is very similar. It's probably an entrance liturgy. There's a few places elsewhere in the book of Psalms. There's at least one place in the book of Isaiah where you've got similar language. The whole idea of appearing in the presence of God, appearing in his holy tent or at the tabernacle, appearing at the temple of God, and then it lists a series of requirements. All of them have the question, then they have the answer in the form of the requirements for appearing before God, and then there is some kind of a blessing or a promise that is given at the end. In ancient times, not just in Israel, these entrance liturgies appear to have been a fairly normal, commonplace thing. For example, the Temple of Horus in Edfu, Egypt. The Temple of Horus, Horus was one of the Egyptian gods. He was a falcon god, and you've probably seen pictures of this falcon god. But at the Temple of Horus in Egypt, there's an inscription that reads this way: O you prophets and priests, all you who enter before the gods, do not appear with sin, do not enter in uncleanness, do not speak lies in his house, and do not embezzle the provisions. It's an entrance liturgy. Basically, if you want to come and worship the god Horus, then you have to meet these certain requirements. And that appears to be what's going on with Psalm 15. If you want to appear in the presence of the Lord, Yahweh, the true and the living God, there are certain conditions that must be met. Now, whether they actually read this when a person came to worship, some think that they read these at the national festivals when the Israelites would come in their pilgrimage to the city of Jerusalem at Passover and Pentecost and at Yom Kippur. Some believe that when the Israelites arrived, a priest would give these requirements, and the people would respond by answering back to him. Whether that was actually the case or whether this was simply an instructional device, we don't really know. But that appears to be what the purpose of this psalm is to describe who is fit to enter the worship of God. Now, you have the question in verse 1, and the question begins in this way: O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? There are actually two images described in verse 1. The first image is that of a sojourner. And the ESV, I think, captures the essence of it when it says, who shall sojourn in your tent? Some say, who will abide in your tent? Now, obviously, the tent could be a reference to the tabernacle, although the word tabernacle is a little bit different Hebrew word. But nonetheless, sometimes a tent is associated with the tabernacle. And I think in the context, that's probably what he's talking about. But it's also the language that we are on a journey in life. And at some point, the person who is on a journey seeks the refuge of his host. If you were traveling in ancient Israel and you happened to spend the night in a particular town, if you went to the city of Jerusalem in order to worship, you relied upon the good graces of somebody else to take care of. And so right away, there is an appeal to grace. Who can possibly dwell in the dwelling place of God? Who can sojourn there? And that word sojourn, again, that's the ESV. Some translation, I think the New American Standard says, who can abide in your tent? But the language here is of somebody on a journey seeking refuge, seeking protection, seeking a blessing by the host. In this case, the host is the Lord. So the first image is that of a sojourner, but the second one gets us closer to the purpose of the psalm. It's the image of someone who is a worshiper. O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? Now, the holy hill is simply where the tabernacle was situated in the time of David. Later, it became the site of the temple under Solomon. But that holy hill, it's not called that here, but it's obviously referring to Zion. Zion was simply a ridge on the southeast part of Jerusalem and overlooking the Kidron Valley. And originally, it was part of the city of David. When David captured the city from the Jebusites, that was initially where he set up his camp or his headquarters. Later, this location called Zion became associated with the city. It became associated with the actual location of the tabernacle and the temple. And in some places, it appears that Zion is sort of emblematic of the entire nation. It is the dwelling place of God. And so not only is this traveler approaching the city of God and wants to sojourn in the tent of God, find a place of refuge, find a place of comfort and dwelling, not only does he want that, but he also wants to be able to approach God in an act of worship. And so, who shall dwell on your holy hill? Who can abide in the presence of God at this time of worship? So that's the initial question. And most of the psalm is taken up with the answer to this question. He starts in verse 2 by saying, here's the answer to the question. He who walks blamelessly and does what is right, and speaks truth in his heart, and does not slander with his tongue, and does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. That is the answer to the question that's posed in verse 1. Now, it's interesting to me that when you look at this list, what you have is a list of 10 virtues. This is sort of a decalogue of virtues, sort of like the Ten Commandments, although relatively few of the Ten Commandments are actually referenced here. But there are a list of positive qualities followed by a list of negative qualities. In verse 2, you have three positive qualities. This man who appears before God must walk blamelessly, he must do what is right, and he must speak the truth. That's followed by three counterpoints in verse 3 that are couched in negative language. The person does not slander, the person does not do evil, the person does not bear reproach against his neighbor. Verse 4, the first part of verse 4, you go back to the positive side of things. He despises vile people. He swears to do good even if it is costly to him. And then the second part of verse 4, you have the negative aspect of that. He does not charge usury. That is, he doesn't charge these exorbitant interest rates. And he takes no bribes. So it's interesting that 10 qualities are singled out, again, both positive and negative. I think that's important. Righteousness is not just a negative thing and not just a positive thing. You remember in Luke chapter 18, the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. They go into the temple, and the Pharisee is primarily bragging about what he's not. You know, I'm not like this guy over here. Righteousness is not primarily about what we're not. It is both what we are and what we are not. I'm not a murderer. That doesn't make me a good person. I don't go around kicking dogs. That doesn't mean that I go around helping people either. You have to have both positive qualities and negative qualities in order to define the biblical concept of righteousness and holiness. And for that reason, you have 10 qualities that are listed. Half of them are positive qualities, and half of them are negative qualities. Another thing I want you to notice is that the positive qualities begin from the inside. This kind of righteousness and holiness proceeds from the inside and goes to the outside. It deals with our attitudes, it deals with our inner set of values, and it also expresses itself in our conduct, and especially in our conduct toward others. And I think both of those aspects are expressed in this list of 10 items. Let's break this down and look at it a little bit more closely. When you look at the answer to this, first of all, he talks about his character in verse 2. His character is absolutely true. Who can sojourn in God's tent? Who can dwell on God's holy hill? The first answer is in verse 2. He who walks blamelessly, he does what is right, he speaks truth in his heart. The idea of blamelessness, it's the idea that no charge can be brought against us. It's the idea that we live in such a way that we cannot have charges brought against us. It's talking about our fundamental integrity in the way that we walk, in the way that we live. And the second component of this is, he does what is right. Several years ago when I was in Louisville, one of the men who had served there for a very long time as an elder died, and his name was Don. Don was a simple man. Wasn't anything pretentious about him. He was not one of these guys that, you know, walks in and just lights up a room. He kind of kept to himself, kind of always over in the corner, very quiet guy, very friendly guy. But the thing I kept hearing over and over when I went to the visitation, when I went to the funeral, when people were talking about him, when he was in the hospital, people said over and over about him, he's a good man. I don't know that there could be much higher praise about a person than to say he is a good man. And that's what this second quality is about. Here is a man who does what's right. When he's presented with the opportunity to make moral choices, he consistently chooses the right thing. It reflects the idea of his blamelessness. What would you expect of a blameless man? He consistently does what is right. And then the last thing it says about him is in verse 2. He speaks truth in his heart. Now, that's almost contradictory, isn't it? How do you speak truth in your heart? You expect truth to be in your mouth if you're going to speak it. And yeah, you can have truth in your heart. I think the point here is that this man tells himself the truth constantly. What you believe on the inside determines what you do on the outside. There are people who lie to themselves every day of their lives. They lie to themselves about what's important. They lie to themselves about what's right and wrong. They lie to themselves about whether or not they're doing the right thing in their lives. Here is a man who, first and foremost, before he speaks truth to others, he speaks truth to himself in himself. The emphasis here is upon the inner truth of this man. He is guided from the inside out by the truth of God. He is very much concerned about that. So what we have here is a picture of his truthfulness in regard to his character. Now, in regard to his words, the actual words that he does speak, he exercises restraint. Now, this is a list of negative qualities. Look in verse 3. The man who sojourns in the tent of God, the man who dwells on the holy hill of God, does not slander with his tongue. He does no evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. When you look at those three things, they deal primarily with the idea of what he says, how he uses his words, how he uses his lips. He does not slander with his tongue. The word slander that's used there could be translated as gossip, and the word that's used there means to walk on foot, to spy, to go and seek out gossip, to spread, to seek out those little morsels that nobody else knows, and I can't wait to tell you about it. That's gossip. That is slander. Slander sometimes is the idea of lying about somebody. Sometimes it may not, what you say may be true, but it's always the idea of unflattering things to say. Here is someone who does not delight in telling lies about other people. He does not delight in smearing the reputation of other people. He does not delight in questioning the motives of other people. Here is someone, he deals with people as they are, and he's going to be very cautious about what he says to other people. Someone has said that gossip is the art of saying nothing in a way that nothing is left unsaid. You can gossip about a person and not really get around to saying much, and yet you say everything by the way that you treat those words. It also says that in the second part of verse 3, he does no evil to his neighbor. Evil is bad enough regardless of who you do it to, but when you do it to your neighbor, when you do it to someone that you know, it takes on an especially hurtful sense. It takes on an especially ugly sense. You care, if you're a righteous person, you care about how your actions affect other people. You always think about the impact, the consequences of your choices. And then the third thing he says in verse 3, he does not take up a reproach against his friend. And the idea of reproach here is a slur or scorn. The word means to cast blame. It means to reproach someone. The kind of person that's described in verse 3, he's not someone who just spends his days looking for bad things to say about other people. There seem to be some people on this planet that are endowed with that gift. They seem to spend all of their time, all of their energy, looking for something bad in somebody else. This person is not like that in any way, shape, or form. He measures his words. He thinks before he speaks. He thinks about the impact of his words on other people. I've known people that they will open their mouths and immediately you see the hurt inflicted on others. And every time they do it, oh, I didn't mean to hurt you with that. And they do it on a regular basis. Get a clue. Get a clue. At some point, you've got to understand that words have consequences. Words can hurt you. Contrary, you remember what we were told as kids, sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt you. Words can be the most harsh things of all. Words can hurt deeply. Words can hurt for a very long time. And the person who is righteous, the person who wants to appear before God in worship, is a person who is very conscious of the power of his words. When you look at his allegiance, it is quite visible. You know who he stands for. You know what he stands for. And so in verse 4, he says, "In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but honors those who fear the Lord." Once again, emphasizing his relationship to other people. What does this man stand for? All of us probably know people that in one setting they're hanging out with the worst of the worst, and they seem to laugh at all the dirty jokes, and they seem to like all the really bad stuff. But you get them in a different crowd, suddenly they're just all holy. Now, I learned a long time ago, I'm a little bit measured when I tell people that I'm a preacher, because in some ways it's probably a good thing. But there will be people I'm talking with, and foul mouth and obscenities and bad stuff is just pouring out of their mouth, and suddenly I mention I'm a preacher. Well, it sort of cleans it up, but now they start acting like holy hypocrites. They want me to know how religious they are, in spite of what they just said 30 seconds ago. The kind of person that he's describing here, he is consistently righteous, he has consistently righteous companions, and he abhors evil in whatever form it appears, with whomever it appears. He abhors that, and you know it. You know it by how he lives. You know it by how he, by whom he associates with, in whose eyes a vile person, and the New American Standard says, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised. This man is consistent. If he sees other people doing evil, he does not delight in it. If he sees other people doing evil, he hates it. If he sees other people doing evil, he'll call them on it. He will not participate in that. He wants other people to know that I don't live that way, and I don't appreciate you trying to get me involved in that. You flip that over, the second part of verse 4, but who honors those who fear the Lord. Not only does he approve of the person who does what is righteous, he honors that person. He lifts that person up. He commends that person. He encourages that person. When you see others doing what is right, how do you treat them? Do you encourage them? Do you give them encouragement to continue doing what's right? Do you tell them how much you appreciate when they're doing what's right? I've seen this many times in restaurants. I know we had this a few times when our kids were little. We'd be in a restaurant, and we'd bow our heads and say a prayer before the meal. Many times people would come up and say, you know, I haven't seen that in a long time. I appreciate you doing that. There were times when, you know, people would say, you know, your kids are awfully well behaved. I appreciate that. I know as a young parent, that just, wow, thank you. That made my day. Even as grown-ups, we appreciate that if somebody commends us for doing what is right. When you see someone standing up for what's right, the kind of person that we're talking about here in Psalm number 15, he commends what is right. He points out when people are doing what's right, and he says, I appreciate that in you. That's one of the greatest sources of encouragement that we can offer to one another. And again, notice the contrast between verse 3, he does not do these things, and verse 4, he does do these things. There are some people who seem to find negative things to say about others, and then there are people, as he's describing here in Psalm 15, when they see good in others, they commend it. They say, you're doing the right thing, and I appreciate that about you. We need to be the kind of people described there in verses 3 and 4. In his dealings, he is honorable with everybody. Look at the second part of verse 4, second half of it. There's about three lines in verse 4. The first two belong to the previous point, but the last point in verse 4 is, here's a man who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest, and does not take a bribe against the innocent. Three things that are said about this man that defines his dealings with others. Here we're getting to kind of the nuts and bolts of his day-to-day life. First thing it says is he swears to his own hurt and does not change. What this says is here's a man who will make an oath and he will keep his word. He will promise you something, and even if it costs him a truckload, he's going to keep his word. His word is so valuable that even if it costs him money, if it costs him time, if it is inconvenient, he will keep his word no matter what. That is a man of integrity. A man who keeps his word and you know it. And if that means it is costly to him, so be it. His word is more important than any money or time or inconvenience or energy that it might cost him to keep his word. That's a man of integrity. Second thing he says is, he does not put out his money at interest. Here's a man that if he sees a fellow Israelite in need, one of God's people who is in need, He will help him out, and he's not going to profit off of it. That's a remarkable thing. Profit is a powerful motive for a lot of people. And when it comes to the subject of money, you can take the most godly people in the world, and if they love money too much, it will change their character, and they will deal with people on the basis of profit. And that's not this man. This man is willing to lose money if it means helping somebody else. He's willing to lose money for the sake of helping someone else. He will not put out his money at interest. Even though he may not make the profit that he might otherwise like, he's willing to help his fellow Israelite. And the last thing, he does not take a bribe against the innocent. Two things about that. Number one, again, it reminds me that money is not his motivation. He is willing, again, to lose money, to pass on the opportunity to make money if it involves how he treats someone else. When it comes to treating people who are innocent, people who are helpless, people who cannot necessarily defend themselves, this is a person who is more than willing to sacrifice any profit for the sake of doing the right thing. That's quite a person, isn't it? You look at this cumulative picture in verses 2 through 5. He walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbor nor takes up a reproach against his friend. In his eyes, a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. That's the kind of person that answers that initial question. O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? And the answer is this kind of person. This is the kind of person who is qualified to stand before God, to present his offerings to God, to worship God. You can flip that over and say, this is the kind of person that God, whose worship God will accept. A person who has integrity. A person who is good on the inside and on the outside. A person who is consistent in the way he deals with others. He despises what is evil, and yet he treats everyone with fairness and dignity and truthfulness. He does not lie about others. He does not slander. He does not gossip. He is careful in what he says, and he always treats people in the right way. That's quite a person. And then the promise for that person is the very last thing that is said in the psalm. He who does these things shall never be moved. I think it's interesting how this psalm ends. It suggests to me that Psalm 15, yes, it's partly about the idea of worship. It's partly about the idea of appearing before God in worship. Who is qualified to come before the Lord in worship and sacrifice? But it also suggests, like the beginning of the psalm, it's much more than just the act of worship. It's much more than simply, okay, am I qualified to show up on Sunday morning? This pervades all of life. Remember, the initial question is, who can sojourn in the dwelling place of God? Who is qualified to walk with God? Who is qualified to spend their days in the presence of God? Now again, in the specific context, probably talking about worship, but that opening question and how the psalm ends suggests there are many more applications beside that. The person who does all of these things, the person who is like the one he has just described, we're told he shall never be moved. He's not saying he'll enjoy many Sundays in the presence of God. He's saying this man is secure from the time he gets up in the morning till the time he goes to bed at night. He is secure in all of his dealings with God. He is secure in his relationship with God from day to day to day, whether it's a day of worship, a day of work, a day of rest, holiday, whatever else. This man's life is secured because of this character that he possesses. So, based on verses 2 through 5, would you be allowed to enter worship? Many years ago, when I was in college, I was traveling one Sunday and I visited this congregation. As best I remember, we were somewhere in the book of Acts, and I think maybe it was in Acts 15 or one of the passages that dealt with sort of the controversies about circumcision, and somebody asked the question, It's one of those questions, they probably should have thought about it before they asked, but they said, well, how could you tell if somebody was circumcised or not? Did they check them at the door? That was actually the question. Awkward. But anyway, I don't really know how they knew. I think they just kind of did word of honor thing, sort of, I guess. But what about your character? Could you check that at the door? How do you know if you're qualified to enter the worship assembly? Well, ultimately, only two people know that, you and God. I mean, you would hope that your character is such that it's visible to others. And much of what is described here in Psalm 15 suggests a visibility about your character. You've let your light so shine before others that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven, obviously. But what's your security badge? Do you belong here in worship? That depends on what you bring into it. I want to conclude with a few other things, just some observations. If you press some of the details of Psalm 15 a little bit too hard, you may wind up with a little bit of a skewed impression. I think Psalm 15 offers us a little bit of balance. First of all, there's a balance between the holiness of God and the approachability of God. You look at that list in verses 2 through 5. As I said, there are 10 qualities there. It's kind of a decalogue of virtue, a decalogue of morals and ethics. The number 10 usually symbolizes something that is complete and lacking nothing. Here's a man whose character is complete, and let me tell you, if you want to approach the holy and living God, this is the kind of character that you must have. But now, I can look at Psalm 15 and say, well, I don't know, I had trouble with verse 3 this week. I've been struggling with my tongue lately. I've been struggling speaking truth in my heart. There are going to be days you're going to struggle with some of these items. There are going to be days you'll struggle with every one of them. And yet, here's the rub about Psalm 15. God still wants you to come into His presence. He is holy, and He understands that we are sinners, but He has made it possible, through the provision of His Son, Jesus Christ, to approach Him in worship. Remember in Hebrews 4, we are encouraged to approach the throne of grace in boldness. Yes, He is holy. Yes, we are sinners. But in the provisions of His Son, there is a way of approaching Him. God is approachable, and God is holy. And I think in Psalm 15, that invites us to come into His presence. We're reminded of those two things. We're also reminded of the balance between God's grace and our works. The kind of person described in Psalm number 15 is a person who is dedicated to good works. But let me tell you something. You can do everything that is required in verses 2 through 5. Suppose you have a sin-free life, and you come in on Sunday morning, Lord, let me in. I'm here. Had a great week this week. I deserve to be here. No, you don't. None of us do. We are unworthy to enter the presence of the living God because of our sins. He allows us to come into His presence by His grace, by His love, by His mercy. He allows us to come into His presence despite the fact that we sometimes come to Him with lives marred by sin and failure. Yes, I need to bring Him good works. Yes, I need to do everything I can every day in His kingdom to show the gratitude that I feel for the salvation that has been offered me in Jesus Christ. But I am still totally and wholly unworthy. And in Psalm 15, I think we see the relationship between grace and works. In Psalm number 15, we see the relationship between our character and our service. Psalm 15, verses 2 through 5, deals with both of those aspects. Many of the things talked about in Psalm number 15 are internal qualities, and I love that in verse 2. He speaks truth in His heart. What you are on the outside depends on what you are on the inside. And don't ever miss that point. If you got a problem with your behavior, it's because you have a heart problem. If you're not what you ought to be in relationship to others, if you don't speak to others the way that you ought to, if you don't have the right attitude toward others, it's because somewhere in the depths of your heart you've got a flaw that hasn't been fixed. Our character and our service are tied together, and we can't untie them. If you want to be the right person on the outside, you have to be the right person on the inside. And Psalm 15 so very capably reminds us of that. And one other thing that I think is worth noting, it shows us the balance between our worship and our morals. What allows us to enter the presence of God? Well, if Psalm 15 means anything at all, it has to do with our character. We bring a certain character in the presence of God. This is what He desires of us. He wants this kind of people. You remember in John 4, Jesus talked about those who worship the Father in spirit and in truth. He said, for such people, God seeks to be His worshipers. There's a certain kind of person that God wants in His presence, and Psalm 15 is a description of that kind of person. God wants us to be in His presence. But once we come here, what do we do when we leave? We go out and we do more of the same. We bring a holy and godly life into worship. It helps us worship God in the way that we should. And when we have worshiped God in the way that we should, we leave and we become people of character all over again. It's an endless cycle. We worship, it helps us become the people that we ought to be. When we are the people that we ought to be, it helps us worship, which helps us live right, which helps us worship right, which helps us live right. It's a back and forth process, a never-ending thing. Our character, our morals, and our worship all go together, and they can never, ever be separated from one another. How you worship depends on the kind of person that you are, and the kind of person that you are depends on how you worship. There's a lot that Psalm 15 doesn't say about worship. It doesn't tell us if there's a right way to worship. It assumes certain things about that. In the context of Israelite worship, it's thinking about all the provisions of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy. That's in the background of this psalm. And we need to carry that over into our worship as Christians. There is a right way to worship God, and we need to be aware of that. This is not talking about arbitrary modes of worship. We don't bring to God what we think is a good idea. We bring to God what He has asked of us. So there's a lot that's not stated explicitly in Psalm 15. But get this, He wants us to be a certain kind of person to enter His presence. So as you come here today, or as you come here tonight, or as you come here on Wednesday night, or any other time, do you belong in the assembly? Do I belong in the assembly? That depends on how you answer the question posed in verse 1 of the psalm. Lord, who may sojourn in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? The kind of person that He described in this psalm. Are you that kind of person? If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, you need the kind of character that stems from the cleansing of God. Only God can make you fit to worship Him. And that happens when we obey His Son as Lord, when He washes away our sins in baptism, when we come to Him with this appeal to become what He wants us to be. When you do that, you are made fit to be His people. You're made fit to enter worship on His terms. For those of us that are Christians, sometimes we aren't the kind of people that we ought to be. Sometimes we don't worship in the way that we should. Usually for people who are Christians, more often than anything, it's an attitude thing. Maybe our hearts are not what they ought to be. Maybe our hearts are not where they ought to be when we worship. If that's the case, then we need to make the necessary corrections. We can help you with that today. We invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.